This Friday, May the 27th, the National Symphony Orchestra and Chief Conductor Jaime Martín bring one of the world's great singers, mezzo-soprano and Sophie Von Otter, to Dublin to perform a selection of Schubert Lieder at the National Concert Hall. It's an evening which delves deep into the romantic realm, with the programme also featuring two works by Mahler, Blumina, a once lost musical jewel, and his first symphony, more commonly known as the Titan. Delighted to welcome back to studio Jaime Martín, and for the first time to have Anne-Sophie Von Otter here with us in studio. And I see immediately, Anne-Sophie, that you enjoy a bit of fun because you were definitely doing a little bit of bopping along to,
to our theme groove.
You kind of can't sit still. When
No, I can't. It's true.
Does Schubert do the same thing for you, or is it a very different
type? Depends which song you're talking about. But Anne Sylvia has a bit of a groove. Dun, 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 dun. That has a groove.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's from a Shakespeare play, of course.
That's true. Two Gentlemen. The terrible translation, apparently, compared to the original. But it's a lovely song that always sticks in people's minds.
What is it about Schubert? Because as you quite rightly said when I asked you about the groove and Schubert, it's very hard to pin down what a Schubert song is. First of all, there are about, 600 that he composed in a very short space of time. But they really do cross so many different styles, so many different moods, perhaps.
Yes. Well, I guess most of them have his melancholy, and but also a sweetness to them. That's sort of his trademark, that, that you can sense as this person had a lot of sadness or melancholy. But there's also quite a lot of joy. But I don't know what you can say about Schubert. You have to listen to it and you have to grow or sort of live with it. I'm coming to Schubert now at my old age. When I was younger, there were a few songs that I liked and some of the chamber music, but it's definitely growing on me in big time. Oh. Which is wonderful because, you know, we all know that Schubert is a great composer and I just didn't get it. But now I do, so I'm very happy about that.
I think you were doing okay back in 2003 now, I might say, in this recording that I'm about to listen to, when you did perform. Yeah. These are orchestral arrangements of songs of Schubert, perhaps the most the best known, perhaps the most famous, if not Anne Sylvia, it would be Diafrella, the Trout. Mm-hmm. Let's have a listen to this recording from 2003, which I think the man sitting in the seat beside you was performing on as a flautist.
Yes.
So let us listen closely to both the voice and the woodwind section.
Concentrate on the flute.
Here we go.
Schoss in Flor ein, die launische Forelle vorüber wie ein Feind. Ich stand an dem Gestade und sah in süßer Ruh, ist unten Fischleins Bade im klaren Bächlein zu, des unten Fischleins Bade im klaren Bächlein zu. Ein Fischer mit der Rute wohl an die Mauer stand und saß mit kaltem Blute, wie sich das Fischlein wand.
And there we go, a little flavour there of Diafrella, the Trout, the Schubert song, one of the songs that Anne-Sophie Von Otter will be singing in the National Concert Hall on Friday evening. And Jaime Martín will be conducting the orchestra and not playing in the orchestra as he was in that particular recording. You remember it, Jaime. How unfortunate that Benjamin Britten didn't give the flute that bubbly sound rather than the clarinet that bubbly sound at the beginning.
It doesn't matter if the flute or the clarinet. The amazing thing about those concerts was to listen to Anne-Sophie. Mm. I mean, you know what, this recording, it comes from a live concert. This was live concert in Paris, Cité de la Musique, with Claudia Abbado conducting.
Yeah, wonderful.
And when you think of how many things can go wrong in a concert, or, you know, to repeat, and actually this recording is the concert. And it was so difficult for us in the orchestra to play it because we were basically listening to Anne-Sophie thinking, wow, Isn't it amazing?
And when you listen now, Anne-Sophie, how critical are you on yourself when you listen back there?
Well,
you think,
this is quite an old recording now. I don't know how old it is.
2003, I think. Yeah, so nearly 20 years, I guess.
2003? Well, maybe it was made a few years before. Right, whatever. Okay. No, I listen to myself, if it's a recent recording, then I'm super critical. But if it's as old as 20 years, then I can hear it's a younger version of myself, and I'm actually quite touched sometimes that, oh, that's nice, because you can hear the freshness in the voice and how sort of easy. I mean, it's never easy, but no, I enjoy it. I enjoy it. I don't listen to myself very often, and so hearing it, it's nice.
Yeah, it's a pleasant experience. And particularly, I suppose, in the case of the Trout, it struck me, you know, Extinction Rebellion was alive and well in the time of Schubert, it would seem. Because even though that song sounds as if it's so pleasant about somebody standing on the bank watching this fisherman, in fact, it's very anti-game hunting and anti-fishing in any way, shape or form. It's quite a conservationist, quite an environmentalist song, really,
well,
isn't it?
Well, unless you say that the fish is a man fishing for women and look what he did, you know.
Yeah, because there's a verse missing at the end, isn't there?
Maybe, yes, but they say that, you know, all leader songs are about sex and gender and stuff like that. I don't know whether that's true, but I think in this case, maybe there's something to it.
Yeah, I think that there's a final verse where there's mention about, you know, that you need to avoid men with fishing rods.
They're all right.
And I think that might be metaphorical.
Yes, I
have a funny feeling it might be. But the relationship with Jaime, you know him from that time, possibly as a musician from that when that recording is made. How has the relationship with him as a conductor developed over the years? You seem to be good friends.
Well, then we didn't see each other for a while, and then we met in Sweden again.
We did the
five, six years ago.
Yeah,
and we did L'Inuidité.
Yeah, in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And now we are here.
But our
mutual conductor friends, Scholti and Abado, sort of bring us together.
No, the first time I worked with Anne-Sophie was with doing Così fan tutte. We were just talking about this. It was with Scholti.
A touring version of Così.
But that was a long time ago.
So with René Fleming.
René Fleming and...
We had a ball, as they say.
Yeah.
and that shifting from, I know it's to a singer, it probably seems like the most natural thing in the world, shifting from the operatic world that you're speaking about there to the world of leader. How different are they?
Well, it's all singing and it's all music. And I sing a lot of other stuff too, like Baroque music or Renaissance music or pop music or contemporary music.
Yeah, you're involved in something with Rufus Wainwright, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, he's written three songs that he hasn't recorded himself, and he sort of didn't give them to us, but we are doing those songs. He's given us permission, me and Brooklyn Rider, wonderful American string quartet. But, you know, it's all different styles, different languages, and but it's all music and wonderful to do.
I want to play another little bit of Schubert, and this is because that's an orchestrated version. I mean, the leader are quite often just with piano,
yes.
So it's really a small chambers type of style. But here we're getting it with orchestra, which is a different thing altogether. In the case of the piece I'm going to play now, the romance from Rosamunde, it was Schubert's own orchestration.
Yes.
It was music. It was incidental music for a play.
Yeah,
a little bit more drama, perhaps at play here, do you think?
Well, not that particular song is very sad about someone who's died and meeting in the afterlife. So this the song from Rosamunde is very Austrian, I would say. It has some mountain feeling to it, sort of there's a sort of yodel in the but not so dramatic. I think you're thinking of the Erlkönig.
Yeah, we'll come
that's
to that.
A killer.
That is real drama. But let's have a listen to this, because it's the play between the minor key and the major key that really interests me, because it's bright, it's dark, it's bright, it's dark. Let's listen to how that works in the song itself.
Thank you.
Wanted to go back in to let it go into that second stanza. That shift from, you know, you hear this pleasant major key kind of introduction, then it just slips into that sadness of the minor key. Schubert really knew how to play those kind of that happy sad thing off each other, didn't he?
Yeah, I think all the good ones do. I mean, Bach has it and Monteverdi has it, and isn't it wonderful that major, minor affects us, the minor keys affects us also so in such a big way and instinctive way?
I suppose it's like the blues music, the way that kind of that minor note at the top end of the blues scale kind of gives us that same kind of downbeat thing, but there's some joy in there somehow as well. Jaime, Mahler mixes in with all of this. How does his music, because a couple of weeks back we were talking about the Songs of the Wayfarer cycle, on which really Symphony No. 1 takes lots of its cues from that
were you
song
doing
cycle.
The Wayfarer?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't do it myself. Somebody else.
It was done, and we spoke about it here on the programme. The symphony itself, this is when he says, well, it is a Symphony No. 1 after all. This is when he says, this is when I finally worked out who Mahler was. How young was he when he worked that out?
Well, I mean, almost the symphony. He was writing the symphony all his life until the moment he did write it. I mean, it's like it's almost like a description of life, you know. What I love about the symphony is just this opening, like starts from nowhere, you know. And I think this is it's like a morning, and you hear the birds, you hear the. It's like an ancestral beginning, but I find the symphony incredibly deep, you know, when you go into the third movement.
Yeah, I'm going to start the third movement underneath this, because this is a live recording once again, in fact. So there's a lot of coughing and spluttering at the top of this, and the third movement is so quiet as it starts out, you can barely hear it. But it starts with the timpani. Quite an ominous opening here, and quite a dark sound that we're beginning to get. You just describe what's happening as that third movement. You won't hear it because you don't have headphones on, but I can hear it starting here, just the timpani in the background.
He's basically using a children's song, Frère Jacques. We all know this song. And then
and it starts to build, really.
But the thing is that the song is in major key, as you were talking
usually,
earlier.
Usually, this is why major. I wanted to talk about this
then,
minor
and
major.
And then suddenly
thing.
Mahler takes this into a minor key together with a timpani. Boom, boom. So it becomes a funeral march. And this is a funeral march with a children's song. So it basically is complaining. Mahler was complaining about the terrible thing was happening at that time was the child mortality was over 53% for children under 5 years old. It was incredibly high child mortality, and this is what this music is showing. It's showing the drama of, you know, children's song, but at the same time, later on in the movement, suddenly you have a dance, which is. And then people at the time, they were very unhappy. Well, why do you put a dance, a Jewish dance in the middle of this funeral? And the thing is that this is what was life at that time. I mean, you had this tragedy of a child dying. Most families yes. have it, and the idea of a white coffin with a family behind on the street, but then in the corner was a bar where people were dancing and drinking because life was, that was life. And this is exactly what this music is showing, which is quite... It's quite hard, you know. It is extraordinary, and I find then the movement finishes very soft, and then it's like the most unbelievable, like the gates of hell open in the fourth movement. It's basically so like the Dante is all about hell and yada-da-da.
Well, let's just listen to the beginning of that fourth movement, because as you say, it comes out of that very gentle, that very gentle minor key version of Frère Jacques, and then this is
every
what
time
happens.
The pa-pa-pa-pa, that's hell.
Did you play in that? That is a battle once again
this
with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra.
I didn't play in that recording, but when we were talking about what recording, since we had a Claudio doing the
during the Schubert
the
songs,
Schubert, I thought, let's have Claudio doing Mahler.
But as you said earlier, Anne Sophie, the drama in the high drama, really in terms of the Schubert songs, I think that you're performing really comes in Der Erlkönig.
Yeah.
This is kind of an epic poem, because some of the other songs are really little lyric poems. But this is more of an epic, and it's from Goethe. Yeah. That was a huge relationship, Schubert and Goethe. Schubert seemed to really take something particular from Goethe poems.
Yeah. Yes, I'm not the right person to talk about poetry and relationships between. I'm not so good at all that. But the amazing thing is that Erlkönig tells this terrifying story of the child seeing the Earl King, who then kills him. And Schubert wrote this when he was like 13 or something.
Only a teenager, yeah.
Super young. And it's written for piano, but it's incredibly hard to play. It's not a piano. It's not written for the piano. I mean, it's much better, makes much more sense to do it with orchestra, because obviously he has all the orchestral colours in his head, even though he was so young. So, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I can't even... Yeah.
Well, let's have a listen to the orchestrated version. The orchestration is by Hector Berlioz, who is a man who knew a thing or two about orchestration, let's face it. Here's a bit of the opening of Der Erlkönig. High drama indeed, and we don't even get to the middle section when I don't know how high it goes for the soprano voice in that when she has to roar out that "Mein Vater, Mein Vater, My Father, My Father." Mm. It does. It seems to go quite high. Or is
it
that
hurts.
it's that high. Are you effectively playing four characters really in that?
Yeah,
song?
The boy, the father, the Earl King, and the narrator. Yeah. It's an exciting song to sing, but it's not done in concerts with piano very often because it's just impossible to play it. It's easier on a fortepiano because the touch of the fortepiano is lighter.
Yeah, this is an old style piano which wouldn't have quite the power of the modern grand piano. I'm not surprised that you leave that song to last in the recital.
It's hard to follow with anything, except maybe an encore.
Do you leave yourself open for an encore then after there?
Well, you go out, you have a drink of water, and you come back in with new energy, hopefully, for an encore. Maybe always depends on what the audience thinks.
Yes,
they want to hear an encore.
They have to want it, and then they have to earn it if they want it, I guess. there's a bit of that as well. Well, listen, lovely to have spoken with both of you this evening, and delight to have you in studio with us, and lovely to have met you, Anne-Sophie. Jaime, a pleasure as always. Mahler Symphony Number 1. I should ask you just, Blumine, it kind of completes the symphony. It was going to be part of Symphony Number 1, kind of lost. Sometimes it is performed as part of the symphony. You're doing it as an overture.
Well, it lasted 3 concerts. In the time of Mahler, he used that as a second movement, and after 3 performances of the symphony, he decided to leave it out.
Yeah,
and I think it is an interesting piece, and I wouldn't want to do what, you know, if Mahler decided to take it away, I don't want to include it in the symphony, but as a complement to understand the piece, I am going to start the concert with Blumine, just to see.
And the trumpeter has quite a task in that, really, doesn't he or she?
Fabulous trumpet solo, so he's looking forward to it.
Well, he is now, whether he likes it or not. That's Mahler's Symphony Number 1, Titan, and Mahler's Blumine as the overture. And then in the middle then will be those set of Schubert songs, the Romanze from Rosamunde, Diaforella, Der Weisweger, and Sylvia im Abendroth, and Der Erlkönig to round things off, unless you're very nice on Friday night and you ask for an encore and Anne-Sophie von Otter is ready and has had enough water to get back out and do that. You can find out full details of the concert on nch.ie. Set in the wilds of Dartmoor, where a monstrous canine is at large, The Hound of the Baskervilles remains one of Arthur Conan Doyle's most popular Sherlock Holmes novel. The story was serialised in Strand magazine in 1901 and 1902, represented a dramatic comeback for the great detective. Conan Doyle had tried to kill him off in 1893 by letting him plummet to his death over the Reichenbach Falls alongside his mortal enemy Moriarty in the novel The Final Problem. But tomorrow evening, Daryl Jones gives a public lecture about the novel to celebrate his new appointment as Professor of Modern British Literature and Culture at the School of English in Trinity College, Dublin. And delighted to say Professor Daryl Jones joins me now on the line. Congratulations on the appointment, first of all, Daryl. Why this book, why this author for your inaugural lecture?
Oh, hello, Sean. I've always been fascinated by The Hound of the Baskervilles, particularly, and by Arthur Conan Doyle. I'm not, in a conventional way, a great devotee of Sherlock Holmes, in the sense that I'm not one of these Sherlockian people who, you know, can tell you every detail of the chronology and life of Holmes and all his cases. But I am very interested in the supernatural, in Gothic fiction, and in folklore. The Hound of the Baskervilles is a perfect choice for that. You know, it's a novel which treads this very fine line between the rational material world of the detective and the Gothic folkloric world of the great Grimpen-Mire and Dartmoor.
But even that name, Grimpen-Mire in Dartmoor, there is a kind of a Gothic quality to The Hound of the Baskervilles that isn't there in the kind of rational novels in some ways in which Holmes normally appears.
That's right. So Holmes, Conan Doyle originally wanted to write a Gothic novel. The Hound of the Baskerville started life not as a Sherlock Holmes novel at all, but as a supernatural tale based in Dartmoor. He found out about the folklore of Dartmoor from his friend Bertram Fletcher Robinson, a journalist whom he met in the Boer War in South Africa, as a matter of fact. Conan Doyle had planned to write with Fletcher Robinson a supernatural tale tale, a folkloric tale. But the money involved in bringing Sherlock Holmes back to life was just too much to resist. Mm. And so Sherlock Holmes interposed himself into this folkloric story. And so there's this great tension, I think, between these two worlds in the story.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the money that brought Sherlock Holmes back. Arthur Conan Doyle, like people, his fans and fans of Sherlock Holmes were aghast and appalled that Holmes should have died at the end of the final problem. And there were almost protests on the street about it.
There were. So clerks in the City of London were said to have donned black armbands in mourning at the death of Holmes in 1893. And Conan Doyle got hate mail. You brute, one correspondent wrote to him. And there were societies to bring Holmes back to life formed and this kind of thing. So Holmes had, and always had, I think, this very vivid sort of extra literary life. He's not quite a literary character, but he's not quite a human being either. He has some sort of shadowy existence between the two of them.
Yeah, and I mean, one can only think if we were in a time of social media, which we weren't back at the beginning of the 20th century, obviously. Can you imagine the outcry, the Twitter storm that there would have been when Holmes disappeared? And probably it would have been more than hate mail. It would have been pretty bad trolling that Conan Doyle would have gotten.
Oh, I imagine so. I mean, people were very deeply invested in Holmes. I think partly because he has this almost kind of this almost kind of mystical significance. He is the man who knows the answers to the complex problems of the modern world. Mm. You know, if you're living in London at the time, it was the biggest city in the history of the world, and it was simply too large and too complex for any one mind to get to be able to fathom, except for one mind, of course, Sherlock Holmes himself.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the television series with Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock Holmes. And yes, while he may understand a lot of things, in this clip he makes a shocking admission to Martin Freeman's Dr. Watson.
What have we got? We know there's footprints, because Henry found them, so did the tour guide. But we all heard something. Maybe we should just look for whoever's got a big dog.
Henry's right.
What?
I saw it, too.
What?
I saw it, too, John.
Just a minute. You saw what?
A hound. Out there in the hollow. A gigantic hound.
Look, Sherlock. We have to be rational about this.
Okay.
Now you, of all people, can't just... Let's just stick to what we know, yes? Stick to the facts.
Normally the other way around that conversation happens, isn't it? That's Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock Holmes, Martin Freeman as Dr. Watson, and clearly the Hound of the Baskervilles getting into the head of Sherlock Holmes. Daryl Jones is with me this evening speaking about the novel itself, The Hound of the Baskervilles. Its gothic credentials, how strong are they? I mean, certainly on the basis of that clip, you'd have to say that Sherlock Holmes himself, the most rational man in the world, seems to be drawn into the gothic nature of this hound.
Yeah, that's right. He says himself that he may find himself in the novel combating the father of evil. He might be at odds with the devil himself when he goes to Dartmoor. This springs from the sort of contradictions and tensions in Conan Doyle himself. He was a man with a foot in both worlds. He was a doctor. But he was also a spiritualist. He was a firm believer in the supernatural. But he was also the creator of Conan Doyle, who is literature's greatest rationalist. No ghosts need apply, he says at one point in The Sussex Vampire later on. And this is one of the reasons, of course, why why Conan Doyle was always so keen to kill Sherlock Holmes off, because the two were so powerfully at odds. But Conan Doyle, who, you know, was a strong believer in the afterlife and the spirit world, Conan Doyle knew more than anyone that the death is never the end, and so Holmes kept returning back to life.
Yeah, and it's not only this hound and that folkloric aspect that's in the novel itself. As is typical in a Gothic novel, the landscape, as I mentioned, Great Grimpenmaer, that place in Dartmoor, even the name itself suggests something Gothic. How atmospheric is the Hound of the Baskervilles in that respect?
Oh, extraordinary. The Great Grimpenmaer itself, which is his Conan Doyle's sort of gothicised version of an actual bog, Fox Tormire, in the middle of Dartmoor itself, not far from Dartmoor Prison, as a matter of fact. This is one of the great pieces of symbolic landscape in all of English literature, I think. You know, this terrifying image of this quicksand, this unstable place where, you know, there is no sure footing, where you can never find your feet, and where things can sink in, you know, horses and ponies sink into it, people sink into it, secrets sink into it. Nothing is certain, nothing is stable in the Great Grimpenmaer.
And to what extent is Conan Doyle giving us a kind of social commentary here, maybe the state of the British Empire at the time of writing The Hound of the Baskervilles?
Oh, very much so, and this is one of Conan Doyle's great themes, I think. As I mentioned, he'd just come back from the Boer War, and you know, this presentation of England as this uncertain, this unstable land, where, you know, dark secrets from the colonies come back to haunt England itself. This happens throughout Conan Doyle's writing. It's there in The Sign of the Four. It's there in The Speckled Band, in The Crooked Man, in many of the Sherlock Holmes stories. This is one of his great narratives, is the empire and the secrets of the empire coming home to haunt England itself.
And how much of that is down to Conan Doyle's Irish lineage, do you think, or Irish connections?
Oh, you've got to wonder, you know, quite a lot. I think, you know, I think it's no accident that there's a bog at the centre of this novel, and he's as a man with, you know, two Irish Catholic parents, as you know, he keeps returning to, and he was a very conflicted man about Irish home rule as well. He was a jingoistic imperialist who, as his life went on, became more and more reconciled to, if not Irish independence, then certainly home rule, as his life brought him into contact with Roger Casement, with Erskine Childers, with people who actually, you know, gave their lives for Irish independence.
And I'm sure you're just scratching the surface of the content of your lecture tomorrow night. But thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, Daryl. And congratulations once again on that appointment. That's Professor Daryl Jones. His public lecture takes place tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. at the Sing Lecture Theatre. That's in the Arts Building of Trinity College. The event is free and open to the public, but you do have to register to attend, and you'll find out full details of how to do that on tcd.ie/news_events. Camille O'Sullivan was born in London to a French mother, an Irish father, and grew up in County Cork, surrounded by music that included some of the great and legendary torch singers of the French language, Edith Piaf, Serge Gainsbourg, Jacques Brel. Although originally trained as an architect, Camille went on to forge a career interpreting the music of many of those singers and more. But her latest show, which she's been touring in the UK, she principally pays tribute to the great Australian singer-songwriter and performer Nick Cave. She's back in Ireland now and will perform at the Kaleidoscope Festival of Rusborough House near Blessington in County Wicklow at the end of June, and will headline her own concert at the Olympia Theatre in November. Camille is with me in studio this evening. But first of all, let's have a listen to her interpretation of Nick Cave. I'm going to start with Lime Tree Arbor.
There will always be suffering. It flows through life like water.
Just the the opening stanza there of Nick Cave's Lime Tree Arbor, as performed by Camille O'Sullivan, who's with me in studio this evening. And we were saying as we were listening to that, Camille,
yeah,
just how delicate the music of Nick Cave is. We were talking earlier with Anne-Sophie von Otter about Schubert and some of the delicate songs there.
Yeah.
This has a delicacy that you really have to be careful with.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tightrope. It's funny, I mean, I've been an obsessive fan for years. And I think what's interesting, I realise now they're like, there's many sides to him, but I think he's written some of the most beautiful love songs ever. And the sad songs, I've realised, I don't like moving an inch because I think lyric is king. And with Fergal Murray, who I work with, it's just about almost like a hymn in a way, just make it really simple. And then you go completely crazy and full of anarchy with the mad songs like Stagger Lee or Mercy Seat, which allows for a show to kind of delve into kind of all the aspects of, like, you know, the best of people, the longing in people and the worst of people. So for me, it's almost swimming in his stuff. Like, but certainly for, like, you were talking there about the Schubert there a minute ago, and I was thinking, you know, the delicacy of what she did, and then he was talking about When It Explodes. It reminded me of what happens in Cave stuff too, and that's great. So you can bring people, you can, for rock and wild abandonment, and then take them into a story, which is almost, when I sing, I feel like I'm in a little film. I sing to myself and share it with the audience. And that, in a way, when you sing other people's songs, not that you need to own it, but you need to make it your own and inhabit it. And, and all over these years, probably through having, when relationships went bad, I became a better singer singing his stuff. And the last week when I was in UK, I just was joking with the audiences that I should have checked my outfits before I came on stage, and the wheels are coming off. So we had in the darkness of his stuff, there's a lot of wonderful storytelling, like Dylan and Cohen, and black humour, and not dissimilar to a lot of the great folk, you know, you might call a lot of those great folk writers. But you can certainly, like, you know yourself as an actor, it's a monologue, there's a story, there's a character, and you can really get into that world.
It is a kind of a balance, though, isn't it? And it strikes me, one that you often have spoken to me before about, this idea that you know, you sing the song, it gets to the end of it, and you wonder, where am I? Am I on a stage? Am I singing a song?
Yeah.
Was that what I was doing?
Yeah.
But you kind of are. Yes, you have to inhabit it, but you have to let it inhabit you. You're kind of a vessel for this material. You can't force anything on top of it.
No, I think it's like, I always feel like it's a tight walk, rope walk in a way. You're not singing at people. It's not necessarily being a brilliant singer, but definitely for me, I have to feel that I would throw songs away if I didn't feel that there was something in me that gets moved by it. Because, you know yourself, songs that people love, they make you cry, they make you laugh. And that's what I feel on stage, is to be open, to be fragile, to be vulnerable, whether that's harsh vulnerability or anger or a sadness or loneliness or joy. So it is about, I learned very early on with audiences, especially if I'm nervous, like, you either come on like a tiger, but when you're singing the sad songs, it's through the silence, the moments of kind of think you're working out the song in your mind, as almost for the first time, so they believe that everything you're saying, you're going through, and it's almost like you're doing it. So you take anything from it. You think of past relationships, or you look at somebody in the audience, and so you make it live for that moment.
Imagine it into it.
Yeah.
But to what extent is there a character involved in that, or in fact, would a character kind of confuse things too much?
I've always kind of said, it's Nick Cave, because especially when I was doing Stagger Lee, and there was an 11-year-old last week, and I said, cover her ears, she can't hear these things, oh my God. Actually, during the interval, I pulled somebody down, get that mother and that daughter, make sure she doesn't listen to any of that stuff. I think it would be, you know yourself as an actor, you'd be wrong to say it's a character, because to be honest, you use everybody's lyric. In a way, I would never sing at a party or anything. Like, people always laugh at that, but I find I'm too shy for that. But I love to exist in other people's worlds. And in a way, it just makes a bigger you. So they're all me.
Yeah.
So that allows me to go to dark places. And for some reason, I love doing that. My sister says, I don't understand, you're quite a happy person, but I love going to that place. And then
changing it. And in a way, I suppose it's something I heard in Bowie before, saying that we all have different parts to our personalities. But, you know, maybe from childhood, we stop that. And what happens with like the likes of singing Brel or Dylan or Cohen or Cave, it allows you to go to those places. And what's nice is sometimes you meet people who are quite shy or don't want to go there. And they said, I just opened out, you know.
Yeah.
Or even like you meet 80-year-olds who go like, Mercy Seat, I'm there. And like they're the original rock and rollers. So you don't pretend anything. You know, I mean, sometimes I joke with people I shouldn't bring out Stagger Lee because I didn't sing that song for years because I thought that was too much. But now I'm reveling in the madness of that person. I wouldn't want to meet him on a dark street, but I don't mind a 5 minute, you know.
Singing about him.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel then about Rock and Roll Suicide because you mentioned Bowie there. Let's have a listen.
Shivering, so snarling, as you stumble across the road.
Yeah, Camille O'Sullivan's version there of David Bowie's Rock and Roll Suicide. That was a live performance, and I asked you, did you recognise? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I suppose it's funny. It was a few, you know, it was in the Olympia. It was there with a full kind of brass band, and I think Bowie is possibly, I'm such a fan. Mm. And it was actually at a time when I was listening to the music next door in my sister's room, Pink Floyd and Bowie. And then I'd been an architect, switched to do Brel and Kurt Vile doing those songs. And then my mother says, but you remember you did Moonage Daydream and you love singing around the house. And I thought, oh my God, because he loved Brel, he'd love Vile. Mm. So that thing, I just remember. Oh, it was such a special night, the whole thing. I think it was because maybe it was the third time we ever played the Olympia. It was full of emotion. I think I climbed up on people's shoulders. I wasn't crowd surfing, but I remember there was a swing and they weren't allowed, you know, John, who's now gone from there, he let me go up on the swing and face the audience. And that one was just, that's the kind of song, it's almost like you're feral, you're like an animal. And I remember somebody saying to me in Kinsale before, going, you're like a mouse backstage walking around, terrified, and then you come out like a big tiger. And I said, that's because they're tigers and I'm terrified of them. But a song like that, I always remember feeling absolute, I'd cry my eyes out listening to that, devastation. Not, you know, because there's something like the Ziggy Stardust thing, but it was so, I couldn't, like, it's just so sad. It's like amazing classical music. You just don't know, why does that make you feel like, you know, jumping in the air or cry? And that, and since then, I've sung it many different times, but it had a magic to me, that recording. And we were lucky to,
Yeah.
But we did it there last week I thought I was going to absolutely kill myself. We were in Brighton, I did. And I tell you afterwards, a few people going, gee, you got to do it again and again and again, you know, because it has that passionate, and maybe you always think you sing it like he did, but then you go back and realise he didn't do it like that, but you know.
But that's the important thing, isn't it? That you don't try. You're not going to try to do an impersonation of anybody singing the song.
And you definitely don't look fantastic when you're singing it, because if anybody caught you in mid photograph. Because it's a wildness. In a way, you're sad for yourself, you're sad for them. If there's anything, like I used to tell the band, if you're angry at me or anything, and I'll, you know, play, don't play right, just play wild. And they're looking at, you're talking to really good musicians.
Yeah.
Like, there's a fella who I know in Australia, and he's one of the best drummers I've ever worked with. And I have a band that I work with there. And he was joking. He said, you know, I saw his book for like 5 years later. And I said, why do you have Cuckoo written on it? We were doing a gig in the Sydney Operas. And he said, well, that's the first time I met you. And it wasn't until I worked with you I realised you weren't Cuckoo, but it looked, you know. And I actually relate this back to a guy who taught me, Jan Chap, who used to be the head of Cork School of Music, who was an amazing pianist from Czechoslovakia at the time. And I remember now, I was going, he used to go, you are a wolf in the forest, and you do, because the band always joke I talk like that. And so I think those kind of songs, I know it sounds crazy, but they allow you to be, you know, kind of, I don't know. It's like, for me, I'm quite a spiritual person and I feel, I used to be embarrassed. Maybe it's being half French or whatever. And the Irish, we're free. We do, like a lot of people say that, God, you go for it and you're wild. And I think you've got to give yourself over. So that's the thing of like joyfulness, you know.
You keep talking about this, you know, this other you that exists.
This other, I know, my Sasha Fierce. And I'm going home now to clean my brass and, you know, be quiet with my cat now.
I did read during around the time of lockdown or when lockdown was coming to an end, you were kind of quite happy with that domestic kind of side
oh,
of
God,
things.
Yeah.
Was it scary coming back out on stage or what was the overriding emotion? Was there a need to get back out there?
I think one of my friends said it to me, somebody said, oh, you're really extrovert. And my best friend said, no, I think she's an introvert and an extrovert. And that's why the schizophrenic thing happens, because I'm kind of scared of audiences. I love singing. And then I'm like, oh my God, get me the exit. But once I'm up there, I'm great. Like a lot of the time people have laughed, have fallen on monitors off stage and they said, she's great. She keeps on singing and off she goes again. Because I love the joyfulness of, and especially now, like when I was touring, I was saying to people, have you been okay? And I was nervous. I took this old gown that's falling apart I've had since I was 16 in school in Cork, and I took it with me because I basically wore it for 2 years.
It's like a
and
comfort
I wanted,
blanket
yeah,
then,
like
it?
A sucky blanket. Yeah. They were like, what is a sucky blanket? But and I just said, you know, because for me, I thought if I'm coming back, I wanted to be real as possible. We've gone through this madness, all of us together. And I realise I probably have a shyness. Like, I love meeting you and people one to one. I'm kind of like, I realised as well, I was hiding at home. I get quite shy of meeting people. And then I thought, what a mad situation to get into a career like that. So people would all say, oh, you must be delighted coming back. And you're like, oh, yeah. And to be honest, I loved hiding and I loved kind of doing, like at the start, I tried my yoga and I tried my exercise and then I went, forget that, and started drinking and having, you know, red wine and chocolate and everything was going, you know, the banana bread wasn't going right. So, and I started sewing and doing stuff. I was trying to, you know, kind of, I suppose in a way, it was getting back to, for everybody, going for those long walks, finding out who you were. And actually Fergal and I, because at one stage I was kind of like, oh, you know, like anybody, what do I do? Who am I? Because, you know, a lot of my friends who I'm still in touch with, who are the architects, they're all working. And that was pretty tough for them. And I said, listen, come down here. Let's go to that recording studio outside. It's a farmyard. And it was mental. I mean, Fergal is so good on piano, but we recorded like 150 songs over like coming back every few months. And it was so joyful. We were doing Leonard Cohen and thing. And we had no pressure on us. So that's the next gig, is looking at kind of singing for yourself. But we chose like my friend's favourite songs, my parents' favourite songs. And there's probably a dog barking in the background there. But it's a slow, like we went to New York for 5 weeks to open the Irish Arts Centre. Like when we came back, it was the Pepper Canister, sold that out 4 days, then London a week, then New York 5 weeks for their new building. I was terrified because I'm like this. I didn't know I was opening it, which I would have been gone. Could somebody else open it? And so it turned up, they have this new £71 million kind of new building. Amazing. And like, it was terrifying to be back, but so joyful. Like, I mean, I had to kind of be held. Oh, they let me out one time to sign my CDs. And then I came up to them after. I said, you're never letting me again. They said, Camille, you were terrible. Within 20 seconds, you went up to hug people. And I was like,
lockdown
over there. Yeah. So it was all happening November, December. And so, but it was amazing. So it is great to be back. But I think I'm trying to be open. Like, I'm kind of looking at people and it's a new thing. It's really joyful just to see people smiling and being out again. It's, you know, and even here is being with you. Yeah. So, you know,
great.
And I'll be making no sense, but, you know.
Yeah, well, never mind those people that are listening to us. It's just you and me talking.
Okay.
Listen, great to see
my
you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for coming in to us. That's Camille O'Sullivan. And Camille plays the Kaleidoscope Festival on the weekend of June the 24th through to the 26th. The festival takes place at Rusborough House near Blessington in County Wicklow. Lineup includes the Divine County, Jellyfish, Feeder, James Morris, Ryan McMullen, Ham Sandwich, many more. KaleidoscopeFestival.ie for full details. And that show that Camille was telling us about in the Olympia in November 26th, that is, of this year. Getting full details on the show, on Camille's and her other plans on her own website, CamilleO'Sullivan.com.